It is July the 12th. This is a Bina class. It's titled The Temple in Its Glory. And we have several handouts. We have the sheet in front of you, which has two sides. One side of the sheet is a miniature of this blown-up sheet here on the board. The other side is has more detail, which we'll talk about. And we also have this model, which I will set up in a way that everybody can see momentarily. Now, before we get into the handouts and the props and all that, let's give some background about the class in general, what we're doing over here, and what we're going to try to accomplish. We have a three-part series today, Wednesday evening, the 15th, and then Wednesday evening, the 22nd. That's our three classes. Right, is that true? 15th, 22nd, right? I believe so. Okay. Sounds good. Okay. The idea of the class is really Mrs. Silverman's idea, and she said that this is the period of 3 weeks, as we know. And during the 3 weeks, our goal is to focus on the Beis HaMikdash, on the temple, and mourn for the fact that we don't have it. On Tisha B'Av, unfortunately, we're going to sit on the floor, we're going to mourn and cry for the loss of the Beis HaMikdash. And she said that typically during this time, classes are given focusing on all the tragedies that took place. And what she suggested, and I thought it was a good idea, was instead of doing that, focus on what was the time of the temple in its glory, to know what it was when it existed, what was it like having it in our midst. Because by understanding that, then when Tisha B'Av comes around and we can think about the fact that we don't have it, and we'll know what it is that we don't have. And then we can really appreciate what the loss is all about. So that's the goal of these three classes. Now, there are a couple of different things to focus on here. And I'd like to be able to tell you that we're going to do one today, one in class number two, one in class number three. But I'm afraid there's going to be some overlap. But the two basic things we're going to try to do is to give the layout of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple, which is why we have the props and the handouts, so we can understand geographically what happened, where were you standing when things happened, how did it look. And the other thing we're going to try to do is present what actually happened, the miracles that happened daily in the temple, what was the experience like, not just geographically, where were you standing, but what was the experience like? What did you encounter when you came to visit the Beis HaMikdash, to visit the temple when it stood in Yerushalayim? Now, a word about the handouts. First of all, I have to thank Mrs. Lipschitz, who, this is actually up in her classroom in Tamima High School, and so was this model. These things belong to her, and she graciously lent it to me for these classes. These little stickies on this larger handout are hers, and they help with you. Marita, I know it's sideways. I put it sideways because this is north, and I figured it would be easier for everybody to understand where everything was if it was that way, rather than the way she had it, which was west at the top. But you have the same handout in front of you without the stickies, so you can see where everything goes. There are various models and two-dimensional drawings of what the Beis HaMikdash looked like that you can get your hands on. And many of them are, how shall we say, prettier than the ones that you have. They're just nicer to look at. They're more detailed, etc. I prefer the black and white, no-frills version, which you have in front of you. The reason why I prefer this is because we really don't know for certain all the details. There's a lot of disagreement, as there is in many things. There's a lot of disagreement exactly how everything looked and exactly how how the dimensions of everything appeared. We have Mishnayos that explain to us what it is the temple looked like, which is a general idea. And the picture you have is based on the Mishnayos, and everybody bases their models and drawings on the Mishnayos. But if you go through different ones online, you can find several, you will find discrepancies here and there, because nobody really knows. So I prefer, in something which we don't really know, to leave more room for imagination rather than pin us down with a specific model that will limit us in how it looked. That's actually the drawback of a model like this that I have in front of me, which is certainly more detailed than the picture. It's certainly more detailed than the picture, but on the other hand, it also means that we're going to be more limited by what it looks like instead of being able to imagine different types of setups. Let us begin with understanding where everything was based on what we know today. What do we know today? What's the one thing that we are familiar with?
Location.
Which is the location of the Temple Mount, and specifically the Kotel, right, the Western Wall. That we know. That we're aware of. So, what is that? Where was it? Where are you standing relative to this whole diagram? Where were you standing? Where are you standing when you are there in Jerusalem today, standing at the Western Wall? Now, if you take your handout and turn it over to the side that has the courtyard. Now we're going to hold it as I have it in front of me. We're going to hold it this way, which is north at the top. This diagram has a very small picture of what we have up here on the board. That part is the temple itself, and we'll get to the temple. The larger perimeter around the temple is the wall around the courtyard, around the Temple Mount. There was a square courtyard around the temple, and as you see, the temple was not exactly in the middle. As you see, it was kind of off to the north and the west. In the southern part of the courtyard, there was a lot of room. And on the eastern part, there was a little bit more room. But on the north, there was a very little bit amount of room. And on the west, there was almost no room between the wall of the temple and the wall of the courtyard. The wall that is standing today, the Kotel, is not the wall of the temple. It is the wall of the courtyard of the temple. It is the western wall of the courtyard of the temple. That's what you're facing when you're standing in front of the Kotel. Now, what direction are we facing when we're standing at the Kotel? Which way are we facing? We are facing east. It's the western wall, which means we are standing, I'm going to use the large picture here, imagine the courtyard wall running right along this part of the diagram. That would be the courtyard wall. Well, when we stand at the Western Wall, we're facing this way. We're facing east. We're actually behind the temple. You see, the real way to walk into the temple is not from the west side, it is from the east side. You actually enter the temple from here, walking through the main gates towards the west. But when we come to visit the temple, we can't go in this direction. This is all in the territory or control of the Arabs. We come from this side and we stand here facing what we would say is the wrong direction. We're facing east along this western wall behind where the temple actually stood. Yes?
Is there a courtyard wall on the east side that we can't get to? Is there actually...
I don't believe any of the walls are standing other than they found a little bit of the southern wall. But there's the eastern wall, I don't believe, is standing.
Yeah. How long is that?
Okay. So the wall that you have in your picture is supposed to be 500 amos by 500 amos. And ama is, there are different opinions on how long that is, between a foot and a half and 2 feet. So you're talking about 750 feet to 1,000 feet, something in that range. Now, we don't have the whole wall. In fact, the main plaza in front of the Kotel, when we go to visit, isn't even the part that corresponds exactly to where the temple was. we're actually standing a little further south. So if this is, you know, look at your sheet over here, and the western wall, which would correspond exactly to where the temple was, we're actually standing further down here. We're actually a little bit south of where the actual temple was. So we're, of course, to the west, but we're also a little bit south. We have this is the main part of the plaza wall. And that's why when they've gone further south, they've been able to turn the corner and find part of that southern wall as well. But it's the western wall, the main plaza would be somewhere in here, further south. The Dome of the Rock may be obliterated in our day, but the Dome of the Rock is over something. Now, there's a matter of dispute what it's over. Is it over the place of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, of the Holy of Holies? Is that what it stands on top of? In which case, the reason why it would be called the Rock is because the Mishnah tells us that in the second temple, we didn't have the Ark. The Ark, the Aron, that contained the tablets of the law, the Luchos, the Ark, we had it in the first temple, but it was hidden away before the destruction of the first temple. We never had it in the second temple. We will get to, later on, where is it? Where is it? We know where it is. And I'll share that with you once we get further on, perhaps in this class, perhaps in the next class. If I forget, someone remind me. Is that okay? So, they didn't have the Ark. And in its place, the Gemara tells us, the Mishnah tells us, there was an Eben Shesia. There was a stone that was there in the place of where the Ark was supposed to be, in the Holy of Holies. So, perhaps the Dome of the Rock stands on that rock. That's possible. There is another argument that the Dome of the Rock actually stands on the place where the altar was, not on the place where the Holy of Holies was. In our diagram here, I excuse all the stickies. The Holy of Holies would be right here. This is the Holy of Holies. So if the Kodesh HaKadoshim, so if that's where the Dome of the Rock is, that would be the Eben Shesia. It would. I'm sorry. That's supposed to be the Ark right there. Okay. If it's over the altar, it would be over here. This is the altar over here. This is the altar with the ramp going up to the actual altar. You're looking at it from a bird's eye view. This is the ramp that goes up, and then you have the top of the altar here. That would be the other possibility of where it stands. Assuming that it stands on one of these most important sites, then it would be one of those two things. It seems to be pretty recessed. Where it is, which leads me to believe it may actually be the altar, but I don't know, and there's no point in guessing.
Are the dimensions of the dome that the Arabs have, and where are those dimensions on that? Like, is that huge amount of feet?
I don't know.
It doesn't cover the whole.
I don't know. I tried to call the Arab ministry to try to get some information. And I'm giving a class for Bina. I don't know. We can. I don't know. No, I personally don't know. Yeah. No. Yeah. We'll get to Mrs. Starkman is bringing up the fact that there are really two altars. This is the larger one, which we'll talk about the two altars as we move along over here. Now, what's interesting to note is that in order to enter the temple, even to enter the courtyard of the temple, and certainly the temple itself, you had to be ritually pure. You had to be tahar. That applies to both men and women. One had to be completely pure. Now, there are different levels of impurity. For example, we all know that if we come in contact with a dead body, we attend a funeral, then we become ritually impure. And the way that impurity is removed is through the use of the para aduma, the red heifer, the ashes of the red heifer. We don't have that today, which means we assume that we are all tamei meis. We assume that we are all impure with the impurity of having come in contact with a dead person. That's assumed that we all are. It doesn't hurt us, that's fine, but it does mean that when the temple is rebuilt and we want to go visit, we're going to first have to become pure. Because we can't go to the temple until we become pure. There are other types of impurities that are less serious than the impurity of coming mace, of coming in contact with a dead person. And those other types of impurities are removed by immersing in the mikvah. And we're familiar with that. We are aware of the mikvah use for women because the mikvah use for women has an application even today. Even if you're not going to the Temple Mount, there is an application of the laws of family purity. So we're aware of the immersion for women. But if someone wants to go into the temple, man or woman would certainly have to immerse in a mikvah before going to the temple. Now here's an interesting point. Before a woman immerses for the laws of family purity, she has to clear herself very well to make sure there are no separations between her body and the water. And it's a whole process of preparation before she immerses in the mikvah. Men use the mikvah, typically, most men use the mikvah before Yom Kippur, before Rosh Hashanah. Some men use the mikvah daily, some use it every week. When men use the mikvah, they're much more lax about how they prepare for the mikvah. Take a shower and go into the mikvah, that's all. Because when men use the mikvah today, it is only a custom. It is not a law. And therefore, there's no need to be so meticulous about the use of the mikvah. But if a man wants to go to the temple, a man's preparation for the mikvah is exactly the same as a woman's preparation for the mikvah, involving all of the preparatory laws of being very careful not to have any separations between the body and the water when immersing. And therefore, it would be the same as a woman who's immersing for the purposes of family purity. A man would have to do the same thing when going to visit the temple. Yeah?
You mean that every time there was a holiday of Shavuot or Pesach that every one of the Jewish people had to immerse in a mikvah in the proper way before going to the temple?
That is exactly what I mean. That's right. There were a lot of mikvahs. Yeah, there were mikvahs around the Mason English, yes. Yes. Now, why do I bring all this up? Because recently they have begun tours that actually go behind the wall. That you can actually now take a tour and move and enter the area on the east side of the Western Wall. We all stand on the west side of the Western Wall, and now there are tours that take you on the east side of the Western Wall. Well, if you're on the east side of the Western Wall, you're now in the courtyard of the temple. You're no longer outside the courtyard of the temple, you're now inside the courtyard of the temple. The holiness of the place does not go away just because there's no temple standing. The Gemara tells us that when the temple was consecrated, when it was built, the area was made holy forever after. That holiness is never removed. And now that area on the other side of the wall is still considered sanctified. And therefore, if anybody wants to take that tour, they need to become ritually pure, but it's a law. It's no longer a custom. And therefore, even men who are taking that tour, I know several men who have done it, there is a matter of dispute in halacha whether it's permitted to take this tour or not. I know a couple of men who have done it. I don't know if personally I would do it. I think I would be a little bit concerned about the dispute of the law, but there are those who do permit it, and I do know a couple of friends of mine who have done it, and they, before they could go, of course, had to immerse themselves properly after the rigorous preparation that a woman goes through before immersing for family purity. They had to do the same thing before they immersed in order to then go behind the temple wall. Correct. A tamei mei, someone who is ritually impure because of coming in contact with the dead, can go into the courtyard of the temple. There is a certain point where they must stop in the temple itself, which we'll get to, but the courtyard is permitted for someone who is tamei mace, who came in contact with the dead. That is correct. So therefore today, even though we don't have the paraduma, we don't have the red heifer, one can theoretically go behind, and that's part of where the dispute is, of it, just how pure can we get today. That's part of the issue at hand. So there is a discussion about it. As I said, it's a matter of dispute. I am not here to say that it is permitted. It is a matter of dispute. But I do want to point out to you that it's interesting that even today, without the temple being built, we have this application of a man or a woman preparing properly before using the mikvah in order to take this tour.
Is that the tunnel tour?
That's not the tunnel tour. This is a tour where you actually go behind the wall. The Arabs are very, very strict about it. And their rule is that you may not pray. You may not pray. And if they see you, they think that you're praying, they will accost you and throw you out. My friend told me that when he was there, he was hot. And he bent over to, this is what he claims anyway, he bent over to keep the sun off of himself. And then an Arab came over and started hitting him with a stick, because it appeared like he was praying. He may have been praying. But that's what he said. They're very, very meticulous about this. They want no Jews praying behind that temple wall. That's the Arab rule.
Can women go there too?
I think so. I don't know for sure. I assume that's the case. I don't see why it's men and not women. I think it's the same thing.
And the time they come in this, someone was in a Sarah, and after he went out of camp and she was like,
yeah, we'll talk about how far, because one of the you're talking about the mitzora, which is the impurity with the skin disease that is discussed in the Torah. We're going to discuss one of these rooms over here involves the mitzora. And if we get into that kind of detail, we'll show how far the mitzora could go, and then he would have to stop. Okay, so this is the application today, and that's where we stand today. We come to the Western Wall. When we're on the west side of the Western Wall, then we don't need to become pure. One does not need to use the mikvah before going to visit the Western Wall. Personally, I did before I went, because I felt like since it's such a holy place, it's appropriate. But it's not a law. It would be a custom. It would be like before Yom Kippur. It's a custom to use the mikvah. So some people are meticulous to use the mikvah before visiting the Western Wall, but it is not required. But to go behind the Western Wall, that is required by law to use the mikvah. Yeah?
So you're saying all around the outer perimeter, within that, is the holiness?
That's where it begins. There are gradations of holiness. Mm-hmm. At that point, there is enough holiness, enough sanctification, that ritual immersion is required. That's correct. Obviously, the Holy of Holies is called the Holy of Holies because it's holier than the rest. And there are gradations, as we will see as we move along, where each point becomes holier and holier, and there are more restrictions and more requirements to go into that part. And then we'll see that as we move along. Yeah?
You know, the hotel, the part where the men can go in and die to the left, that would be going towards the east. I mean, there's another section behind that that's above.
To the left is not the east. To the left is north. You're facing the wall, and then to the left, you're just moving further north. You're still staying to the west side of the wall. At the men and women section at the Kotel, the women's section is further south, the men's section is further north.
Yeah.
When you enter that building over there, that's still to the west side of the wall. Now, the tunnel tours is a whole other issue, because there, apparently, they are going underneath. And I'm not familiar enough with where the tunnel tours go to share with you the exact rules about that. It happens to be that there is a discussion about whether the holiness of the temple, how far down does it go? When you have the level of the temple, well, what if you burrow underground? What happens then? And that's a whole discussion. And apparently it's not an issue. I've never heard of the tunnel tours being an issue with this business of becoming pure, but I'm not familiar enough with the whole system. Yeah.
When you take that tour, they do tell you that when you're almost at the end of that, that the spot closest to the Kodesh Kodesh, and many people would not be in that spot.
Right, but that's underneath. Right. So I don't know that you're required by law to immerse before that. I'm sure everybody feels that they should, because it's such a holy place, but I don't think that you're required by law because it's so down. And that's a discussion in halakha itself.
If one enters the mikvah, how much time between the time you've entered the mikvah, which I assume is elsewhere from this, that you can actually go forward?
Yeah, that's part of the issue. That's part of the problem. Because it's so easy today to become impure because of the fact that no one else is pure. And, you know, who knows, you shake someone's hand. I mean, it's very difficult to remain pure today because we're not involved in those laws. And so I don't know how that's handled by those. I've never dealt with it on a practical basis. I don't know how it's handled by those who go behind the wall. So if we're to picture ourselves standing at the Kotel, so we would imagine then that when the temple is built, at least in the second temple era, I don't know exactly what the third temple will look like, but in the second temple era, that Kotel, that wall, was much longer, went all the way south and all the way north, and then of course it went along the south and north walls and then an eastern wall. It was a large courtyard completely surrounded by this Kotel, by this wall. But it's the wall of the courtyard, not the wall of the Beis HaMikdash of the temple itself.
Was that built by Herod?
The wall? I don't know how much he built and how much was built before. There was a wall before him. He added and enhanced parts of it. And I don't know exactly the differences of what he did and what was done before him. When coming to the temple, if you'll look on your handout with the courtyard wall on it, you'll notice on the courtyard wall there are several entrances. There were two on the western side, two on the southern side, one on the eastern side, and one on the northern side. So there were various entrances into the courtyard of the temple, which you figure we would need. There were literally tens, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people visiting the temple, and you needed a lot of ways in and out. Fire hazard. Right? You need ways to get in and out of the temple. So you had a lot of different entrances to the area called the Temple Mount. All the walls were very high. They were all tall, including the western wall where we stand. The one exception was the eastern wall. The eastern wall of the Temple Mount, of the courtyard, was a lower wall. This wall here on our diagram was a lower wall. Why was it lower? So this is a fascinating thing. This goes back to the red heifer, believe it or not, the Parah Aduma. If you'll look at on the other side of the page, at the temple itself, which is this picture here. The temple itself, if you'll start with the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, and move, which is all the way on the west, and move towards the east, there is you move from the Holy of Holies to the regular holy area, and then you will see a series of entrances. I know they don't look so much like entrances in this type of picture, but you'll see a series of doorways, entrances, going from west to east. There is one. I'm going to use the larger picture here. It'll be easier, I think. I'll use a pointer. You have an entrance here. You have an entrance here. You have steps. You have an entrance here. You have more steps. You have an entrance here. And then moving further and further east, you will eventually come to the eastern wall of the courtyard, which is somewhere over here. But the entrances line up exactly from west to east until you get to the eastern wall. At the eastern wall, you'll notice there is another entrance that goes into the courtyard. So if you're standing from the east, looking through, let's say you're on the eastern side of the temple, outside the courtyard, looking into the courtyard. That's what you're looking at. So for our purposes, you'd be standing over here, and you're standing outside the courtyard wall, and you're looking through the door. Well, you should be able to see from where you're standing all the way through to the inner sanctuary. That's what you should be able to see.
Even though there are stairs.
Ah, but you can't. Excellent. Because there are stairs. Unless you're really, really tall. You can't see because it's a temple mount. The mountain gets higher and higher as you move along. So you wouldn't be able to see all the way through because you'd be blocked by the fact that it ascends as you move in. But what if you were standing on a very tall area outside the eastern side of the Temple Mount? Well, if you're standing on a raised area looking east, you will be able to see all the way through, if you have good eyesight, all the way through to the inner sanctuary. If you look carefully and you line yourself up exactly right, you could see all the way through. On the eastern side of the temple, where the courtyard wall was, beyond that, there is a mountain. On that mountain is where the red heifer, where the red heifer is prepared. That's where it's slaughtered, and then it is ignited, etc. And they make the ashes of the red heifer. It is all done on the mountain over there, on the eastern side. Why is it done over there? Because the Torah says that although it is done on the mountain outside of the temple, but when the Kohen is performing and setting up this red heifer, he is supposed to look into the inner sanctuary of the temple. So he needs to stand on that mountain and line up and see directly into where the inner sanctuary is as he is performing the rituals of the red heifer. That's what he's supposed to do. That's why all the doors line up perfectly. And that's why the wall on the eastern side is lower than all the other walls. Because he stands on a mountain that's above the temple wall and looks over the eastern wall through the other entrances into the inner sanctuary as he is performing the rituals of the red heifer. Yeah.
What is on that mountain now?
I don't know. That's under Arab control. It's on the eastern side of Jerusalem. The rule of thumb is that the holier the place is, the more it's under Arab control. I mean, that's a fact. That's the way it is. Think of Hebron, right, where the patriarchs and matriarchs are buried. Think of Shechem, Nablus. Right, all these areas are controlled by the Arabs. The holier it is, the more difficult it is for us to get our hands on it. That's the way that things are. That's to remind us that we are not yet redeemed. And those things will change in the future, but right now that's the truth. Yeah.
Were there no curtains in front of the Holy of Holies?
He couldn't see into the Holy of Holies, but he could see into the area right before it. Okay. That's right. You're right. Because that was blocked off. That's correct. The courtyard had a certain degree of holiness that one could eat some of the ritual sacrifices in the courtyard. There are certain restrictions and laws based on the level of sanctity that certain sacrifices had. There are certain sacrifices that could only be eaten by a Kohen and not by anybody else. There were other sacrifices that could be eaten by any Tahar Jew, any ritual pure Jew. There were also restrictions on where you could eat it. So some sacrifices could only be eaten in the courtyard of the temple and not beyond the courtyard of the temple. Others could be taken beyond the courtyard. There were certain rules and regulations set up regarding the different sacrifices. All of the Jews had to know where the lines of demarcation were between the more holy areas and the less holy areas. You needed to know that because you had to know how pure you had to be to take the next step, because you didn't want to take that step if you were going into a holier area and you weren't ready. So you had to know. But you also had to know because there were things that could only be done in the more holy areas and not in the less holy areas. And so you had to know where those lines were. And they were clearly marked, and as we will see when we move through the temple here, these areas were clearly marked off as you went through, and you knew when you were entering a holier area. So let us now move to the actual temple. One thing which is confusing, I believe, to many people, is that, of course, the courtyard of the temple had no roof. If you were in the courtyard and it rained, and you didn't have an umbrella, you got wet. That was the courtyard of the temple. What people, I think, aren't so aware of is that most of the temple itself was also unroofed. Most of it was open air. There's only one part of the temple that was roofed, and that is the inner sanctuary here. That's the only part that was actually roofed. The rest of it was open air. And I will hold this up for you to see, because here they did a nice job of showing that. And you notice that only this, I'm just holding this so it doesn't fall off, only this part here is roofed. The rest of it is all open air. So when you came into the temple, you weren't in a building. You were now in an area that was surrounded by walls, but there was no roof. And that was true for most of the temple. When you came into the temple, let's start from the east side. You came into the temple, into this area here. This is a very, very large area. This is not drawn to scale. You could fit huge amounts of people inside the temple itself. This first area here was called the Ezras Nashim, the women's domain. But the funny thing is, it wasn't only for women. It was called the Ezras Nashim, but it wasn't really only for women. It wasn't only for women. Yeah, everybody went over there. That's where the celebrations were held during the holidays. But it was not only for women. The reason why it was called the Ezras Hanashim, the women's area, is because when that was an area that both men and women would go, that's not an area that sacrifices were offered. We will see where the sacrifices were offered. Once you went further and tried to offer a sacrifice, then they had specific entrances for men and for women. And so this was the area, which is called the Ezras Nashim, because there women and men would both be. Now in times of celebration, like on Sukkot, where they would have huge celebrations and singing and dancing into the night, which took place in the Ezras Hanashim, took place in the women's sanctuary, because that was the large area, that's where it took place. The men were on the floor, and they built a balcony, which is where the women were. And the women watched from the top, the men watched from the bottom. Most people did not dance. The only ones who actually danced were the great leaders of the generation. The great sages, they're the ones, the prophets, they're the ones who actually danced. The men would watch from the floor, the women would watch from the balcony. In order to separate the men and women, that was what was done in the Ezras Hanashim, in the women's area. The women's area had four large rooms in each corner. Yes?
Aside from the regular building, they built another balcony for women?
Yeah, this... They built a balcony around the perimeter of this area. It's hard to call it a building because there was no roof. But they would build a balcony, and that's where the women would stand.
Like when you go to a baseball game?
Yeah. I guess it looked like that. I mean, it was like a balcony, you know, if you've been to a shul that has a balcony, that's what it was like, I assume. Right. Well, they're not covering for anybody. It was a nace that people fit. I mean, there were times when they had limitations in space, and I don't know when the miracle took place and when it didn't take place, but it didn't seem to be a problem. We're going to talk about the miracles of the temple next time. I hope next time. Yeah.
Is there a reason, significance for why it was all open?
Why it was all open? She wants to know why was it all open. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know. Before I get to the four rooms, let me make a couple of other points that I'm realizing we need to make right now. You couldn't sit down in the temple. Prohibited. No one could sit down. You had to stand. Only one person was allowed to sit in the temple. The king. He's the only one who was allowed to sit. The king and only the king from David HaMelech, descendant of King David, was the only one who could sit in the temple. Everybody else had to stand. There was Ein Yeshiva. There was no sitting. No Kohen could sit. Let's say a Kohen is working, he gets tired, can't sit down. He has to go out of the temple to sit down. No sitting in the temple. The four rooms, I'll do these four rooms and I'm going to come back to a different point, which is very important to make. These four rooms each had a separate function. I'm going to go to the board now to show the function of the four areas. You have these four rooms on the perimeter of the women's section. These four rooms each had a separate function. You had the, they are called lishcha. Lishcha means a room, an anteroom. You had up here in the northwest corner, you had the room of the mitzorayim, of those who had become ritually impure with tsaras, with that skin disease. This is where they would go. There was a mikvah, actually, in this room, along with other things that they needed in order to affect their purity. They would go here first before offering their sacrifice. We're not going to get into the exact details of their sacrifice. In the northeast corner is called Lishas Ha'etzim. That's where wood was kept. The altar needed wood for burning to keep the fire going. The fire on the altar had to run 24/7. It never went out. They needed enough wood to keep that going. So they kept a storehouse of wood here, and the wood was constantly checked by Kohanim. A Kohen who had a blemish, who was unable to do work in the temple. A Kohen who was a Baal Mum, who has a blemish, cannot work in the temple. And so those Kohanim, their job was to go through the wood and make sure the wood was not wormy, that it was appropriate wood to be used on the altar.
So it's all had brought up from underneath.
The wood? No, the wood is transported there.
There were many entrances,
but it would be, no.
Were there stables underneath, or was there an arrow?
No. We will talk about tunnels underneath, but we have to get to this area here before we talk about tunnels. The southeast corner was the area of the Nazirs. The Nazir, when they finished their term of Nazir, they had to go through a whole process, and it had involved shaving their hair, and that was done in this room over here. And in the southwest corner was the area of oil. They kept a lot of oil in here because there was a lot of oil that was needed for the service of the temple, in the menorah, and also in some of the sacrifices. Now, why am I going through this in such detail? Because I told you I was going to tell you where the ark is. Because where's the ark? Where do they hide the ark? The Gemara discusses this. Where do they hide the ark? And the Gemara says, it's really a Mishnah that says, that the ark was hidden away in the Mishkas Ha'etzim, in the room of the wood, which is the northeast corner of the women's section. In here, there, that under the floor, that's where the ark was hidden away. The Mishnah says, how do we know that? The Mishnah says, because there was a Kohen, and this Kohen was involved in going through the wood. It's a matter of debate whether the Kohen was acting improperly or not. But he noticed a floor, not board, but a floor stone, that was this color. It looked different than the rest. And he realized there must be something underneath. And he ran to tell his peers, and before he had a chance to say where it was, he died. And when that happened, they realized that he had a secret that no one is supposed to know, and therefore they surmised it must be that that's where the ark is hidden, and no one is to know.
Well, what are you telling us?
I'm not telling you which stone.
Is this the second temple? It happened
second temple, yeah. Because the first temple, they had the ark in here. Yeah, this is the second temple. That's what the Mishnah
says. I thought that was the ark they were carrying away.
So there is a debate. Some say that they took the ark. But most say that they did not. It wouldn't be the Romans. It would have been the Babylonians. The Romans certainly didn't get it.
But the Vatican is not
Now, they have the menorah, but they don't have the ark. That they don't have.
Is that King Yehoyakim?
Which? For what? Who hid it away? I think it was Yoshio. I think so.
And then, as well, of course, the Kohen was one Kohen. The priests, they had a certain amount of hours, certain amount of days that they did their work, and then they waited many months before they were called again. Is that correct? But the Kohen was one, so really, was it just a miracle that he never ran out of
And ran out of?
No place for him to sit. You know, how was he just?
No, they went. They had to go out to sit down. They would be involved here, they would go out and sit down. In order that they have to.
Or out of the courtyard.
What's that? No, in the courtyard you could sit. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you say that we believe that right now that's where the ark
is? I certainly believe that. Yeah. I mean, no one's going to find it. Hashem doesn't want it found. It will appear when we need it. The Arabs won't get their hands on it. Their grimy little hands on it. It won't happen.
And how will we get them to know
that? I don't know. I don't know. That we don't need to have that one. We could build another one. But I don't know. We'll see. Hopefully we will all find out very shortly.
The Pope knows better than
I. What's that?
The Pope knows better than
I. Apparently. Apparently.
It's a place of doing utensils in the temple area, not in the old city. And they say there's a question about whether they should have to do that or not, because they say when the temple comes back, Hashem will provide all the utensils that we need. Is that what you believe?
I don't know. That I don't know. Here the Mishnah says where they are and is. I don't know what's going to happen, you know, with the... I try not to speculate about these things. We'll see, you know. The goal is to bring Mashiach and we'll find out. And we don't have to, then we don't have to speculate anymore. There is another aspect to the Beis HaMikdash which is not so well known, but is crucial to really understanding how things were when you came to visit. I want to call your attention, if you'll look at the larger scale picture, the one that has more parts to it, with the courtyard. I want to call your attention to a funny looking shape in the courtyard on the east side. On the east side, there is a funny looking shape right over here. Anybody see it? Right in over there? That funny looking shape. That same shape appears again on the east side of the temple itself. Right inside the door, the east door of the temple, in the women's section, there is another shape identical to that one. And there is a third one, which is located, this is a little bit hard to see, I'll show it to you on the larger picture here. The third one is right here. On the big picture we have, here's number two, and here's number three, and number one is going to be over there somewhere. Those three things are courts of law. Those are courts of law. Many of you know that the system, the judicial system, with lower courts and higher courts and a Supreme Court, is not new. This was our system that goes back for thousands of years. Our Supreme Court was a body of 71 of the greatest sages of Israel. That group sat here in what is called the Lishkat HaGazis. This is where they sat, in this area here. That's where the High Court sat. There were the second highest court in the land, which is a body of 23 judges, sat here. And the third highest court in the land were the ones on the entrance of the courtyard. So you had the three highest courts of the land. The first one was in the courtyard, which was a lower level of sanctity. The second one was just inside the temple, which was a higher level of sanctity. And the third one, the body of 71, which is the highest level, was the highest court in the land, was here, which is in a higher level of sanctity, the Lishkat HaGazis.
That's the Sanhedrin.
That's the Sanhedrin. That's correct.
How many members in the lower one
each had 23, and the lower two each had 23, the higher one had 71. Now there were hundreds or thousands of courts throughout the land, of 3 or 23, depending on what you were judging. Every city had its own based in, its own court. Every municipality had a based in. There were many batei dinim throughout Israel. These were the three highest courts. So even the lowest of these three was comprised of very great sages. And as you moved further and further into the temple, you came to even greater and greater sages. When one came to visit the temple, obviously you're going to run into Kohanim who are busy performing the service of the temple. And you would likely get to see the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. But you would also see all the great sages of the generation. Because the great sages sat here in judgment. This is where they were when they were judging. The third highest court was here, the second highest court was here, and the highest court was here. And so, coming to the temple, you actually came into contact with not only the, we'll call it the Kohen leadership of the people. We Jews have three arms of leadership. We have the Kohen leadership, the priesthood. We have royalty, which is the king. And then we have Torah. We have the great sages. When you came to the temple, you came in contact with two of the three. You had the priests, and you also had the Torah sages. They were there as well. In addition, the palace of the king, which was built by Shlomo HaMelech, Solomon, was right near the temple. It was located in the same general area. I'm not 100% sure which direction it was in, but it was in the same general area as the temple. And when you came to visit Jerusalem and you went to what we call the Old City, to see, which at that time was the city, to see the temple, etc., you would likely see the priests, you'd see the Torah sages, and you would see at least the king's entourage, and maybe even the king himself. So, coming to this area, the Temple Mount, you got to see everything, all the who's who in Jewish life, you got to see here. It was all concentrated in this area. The Lishkas HaGadlus, which we will get to presently, which had the 71 sages, these sages were not all Kohanim. They didn't have to be Kohanim. You don't have to be a Kohen to be a Torah sage. And so, they could not go into a place that was reserved only for Kohanim. So, we know, of course, and we already discussed, how down here in the women's area was not reserved only for Kohanim. Any Jew could go there as long as they were ritually pure. When you came closer and closer to the holier areas, well, now already, you have to be more careful about who can go where. This Mishkan HaGadlus was built in such a way that where they sat was an area that was permitted for non-Kohens. You didn't have to be a Kohen. You could even sit down in the place where it was built, because it was technically outside of the demarcation line where you had to be a Kohen and where you had to stand the whole time. So that was deliberate so that they could sit in judgment. Judges need to sit when they are judging. Yes? Now that's a good question. Did they have a roof or not? I don't know the answer to the question. It would seem to me that they should have a roof. I don't know how they would conduct business without a roof. But, that's one of those things. It doesn't say it anywhere. I'm assuming there was a roof. Yeah. Well, I don't have parchment anyway, but yeah. Right. Which would mean that area in the courtyard, which also had a court, that court, if the courts were roofed, would have to have a roof on that one small area. And you may be right. You may be right. Again, this is one of those things that just, it doesn't discuss that. It's a detail that wasn't mentioned. I imagine there was a roof. So, those who are made, as I was mentioning before, those who are drawing these pictures, you could draw it with a roof, draw it without a roof. And who's going to know? So, you know. But it's very possible there was a roof on the courts.
Can the judges actually sit inside that?
Right. So this was built in a way that it was outside the technical wall of the courtyard, of the temple. So they were able to sit in that area. Yeah. Yes?
I think I've got the name right. The one on the outside of the
balcony. This is the highest. This is the highest.
Number one, number two, and number three.
Yeah, yeah. This is the highest, second highest, third highest. The further out you get, the lower it gets. What's that?
Has that ever found any parchments near and by over like the first 500 years?
I don't know.
No recording in Michigan where any of that was found.
The what, the parchments?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. Okay. So, we've come to the end of our first installment here, and we've gotten basically up to the main area of the temple. We haven't covered this yet. Next time, which is Wednesday evening, we will begin with the stairway leading from the women's section up to the main area of the temple. We have to cover the stairway, which I'm sure many of you are aware of, with the levium and their instruments and playing songs. We have to cover the main entranceway. We have to talk about the altar and what are all these things over here. We need to discuss the main chamber of Kohanim, which is up here. And of course, we have to discuss the Holy and the Holy of Holies. All of this still needs to be discussed, along with some of the function of some of these entranceways around the temple. I imagine that will take most of the next class. So now that I see how much time everything is taking, I imagine class number two will be a continuation of getting ourselves oriented of what was where, and then class number three will be focused on the experience of what miracles were going on, what did you see, what did you do when you actually came to the temple. Do you have a question?
Do we know how big these rooms were?
I don't know if we know the exact dimensions of those rooms. I don't know, but you got to fit a lot of people. It wasn't just the 71 people. They sat in a semicircle so they could all see each other, all 71. So you had a large semicircle of 71, and then you had many students who were sitting, learning from the sages. So it was a lot of people in that room.
Can you show me the entrances one again?
Which ones? If you look on this sheet, you see where there's a hole in the walls?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's where the entrance is. Right. Okay. Yeah. That's a very good question. How were the judges selected? That's a very, very good question. I don't. The judges themselves selected replacements of judges. The question is how the original 71 were selected. I'm not 100% sure of the process. Remember, when it started, we had prophets. I mean, when it really started was in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. He had 71. It was a few weeks ago we had in the parasha. So that was, he was the 71st. There were 70 under him. So, but it was a self-perpetuating group, which means that as one died, then they would select from the students who was worthy of replacing the one who had passed away. And so it would be a system where you just came up through the ranks. Yeah.
Well, did they understand that they had prophecy?
Some of them did. Some of them did, yeah. In the age of prophecy, many of them did.
So, but as time went on?
The age of prophecy ended in the beginning of the Second Temple era. In the beginning of the Second Temple, there were still some prophets, but as they died, there were no new ones. Yeah. Yeah. She was a judge, correct. There was no temple in her day. It was before the construction of the temple. I mean, Solomon, Shlomo built the temple many years after the vote. Correct, correct.
Are the first temple and the second temple extremely similar?
They're very similar. They're very similar. They're not identical, but they're very similar. I'm not sure of all the details. The general layout is the same. Even the Mishkan, the tabernacle that they had in the wilderness, resembles this to some extent. But everything has the general layout, but... That's correct.
And the third temple in Yad Vashem will be like which one? The first or the second?
It's not going to be exactly the same. Again, the general layout will be the same, but it's described in Sefer Yechezkel. Those who are in the Yechezkel class, we haven't gotten to it yet. We will get to it coming up in the next few months. But it's not exactly the same. The picture is slightly different. I believe that the Art School Yecheskel has a diagram of what they think it's going to look like. But, you know, we don't know exactly.
But the sanctity that was in the first temple will come back into the third?
Yes.
And what are those steps on the side? See the steps on the
here?
Side?
Yeah. Yeah, well, as we said, it's a mountain. So as you move closer and closer to the main area, you're going higher and higher up the mountain.
But those aren't the steps of the
end. No. But even to get to this area here, you had to have steps. Yeah, she's pointing out. There are steps up here. Yeah. Yes?
Isn't all the judges where you sit? They didn't know about the area, where the airport was. They could sit there.
Yeah. That's correct. Okay, to be continued.